From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Capitol Hill is no stranger to scandal, but watchdog groups from the left and right are complaining this week that the brakes are off in the House of Representatives today when it comes to ethics violations. Eight Washington watchdog groups are blowing the whistle on what they call a sweetheart pact in Congress, an informal agreement between Republicans and Democrats not to call each other out for ethics violations. Groups from Common Cause to Judicial Watch describe a kind of ethical free fall on Capitol Hill, a mutually assured discretion designed to put a stop to bloody partisan attacks that is putting an end to any ethics accountability. Tonight on Point, the strange disappearance of ethics oversight on Capitol Hill. And later in the hour, we'll be taking a look at President Bush's opening salvo of campaign television ads. But first, joining us from Washington is Gail Shattuck, who covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. Thanks for being with us, Gail.
Glad to be here.
Gail, accusations of ethical breakdowns on the Hill, that's not altogether unfamiliar, but now we're hearing about some kind of bipartisan deal, a sort of non-aggression pact. What's the backstory here?
This has actually been going on for 7 years. It started after, I think you have to go back even further to the 91-92 House banking scandal, when Republicans had been, the way they took back the House was to constantly raise ethical questions, ranging from a book deal that knocked out the Speaker.
Jim Wright, the
exactly,
Democrat.
Mm-hmm. To a constant, you know, barrage of these ethical accusations. It hadn't been done before. There'd always been a kind of gentleman's agreement around such issues, and Gingrich broke it. If you look at that banking scandal, there were 77 named members who either resigned or were defeated after their names were mentioned.
Mm.
And that, I think, began the sense that this could get out of control.
Gingrich himself became a victim of the free fire ethics battle.
Precisely. So I think sometime around February 97, the leadership got together and said, we could really melt down over this. The Ethics Committee it was so aggressive on the committee that it was barely functioning, and they simply agreed to not bring issues forward. Now, while on the Senate side, an outside group can raise an ethical issue, on the House side, you have to get one of 435 members to do it for you.
So
that hasn't happened in 7 years.
Was this part of the same agreement then in 1997? We won't raise ethics issues, and we won't let anyone from the outside raise them either?
That's right. Now, what's interesting, Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic House leader, was questioned on this very aggressively. And you have to listen very carefully to what she said. She said, there isn't a truce on important things. She said, for example, that she had assurances that the Ethics Committee was looking into these very serious charges that Representative Nick Smith was subject to a bribe and extortion for his vote on Medicare.
Not that the bribe was made, but he said at one point on radio that it was offered, $100,000.
That's right. And she said that that's going on. Now, we don't know that because the Ethics Committee doesn't discuss issues that it's still investigating. But if you listen closer to what she said, it's up to you, the press, to bring these forward. We can only make a claim that there's been a violation if the honor of the House is at stake. And how is it at stake if you don't say that we've been dishonored? And then she said it's up to the Ethics Committee to raise these investigations, but that I will not use the resources of my office to do it.
Gail, so now we have this unusual step this week of eight watchdog groups in Washington, with all kinds of leanings here, making a big stink about this. Why now? Has it just reached a tipping point of issues unaddressed on the table, or something else going on?
I think it has a lot to do with the election cycle. I mean, while these groups did include Judicial Watch, which is traditionally a conservative group, they were the ones mm-hmm. that went after the Clintons tooth and nail mm-hmm. for a very long period. By and large, you know, Common Cause, Public Citizen, these are groups that tend to be closer to the liberal persuasion.
So you see this as part of the election campaign, just partisan griping?
I don't know that it's partisan griping, but I think that the Democrats have learned the lesson of Newt Gingrich. That is, that having other people raise ethical issues, and they're releasing a lot of stuff to the press. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes discussion with Democrats leading us to where we ought to go, but they will not break the truce themselves. So it's a kind of disingenuous game in a way. The truce technically is still on, but the press is being baited to take up these issues much more aggressively than we have, and I'm quite sure we will.
But when you look down the list at the ethics offenders or alleged offenders, there are plenty of Democrats on that list.
Yeah, there are. And that is another point that Nancy Pelosi made. She said, you know, when you raise one of these questions, you have to be prepared for, you know, cannonballs coming at you. Both sides have plenty of issues. With, you know, think about the last election cycle. $1 billion cycled through the political system. And I think there's the press are constantly raising issues about whether or not there's any kind of quid pro quo there. And both sides take a lot of money from interest groups and are vulnerable to those charges.
Gil, with that kind of money floating through, isn't it a problem not to have aggressive or at least active ethical oversight? I mean, the issues that that money raises would seem to be so huge. Isn't it a legitimate thing to point at and say, what's going on here?
It's very legitimate, and I think you're going to see more of it. That was a very important meeting on Tuesday. These are groups of people who don't usually get together in such a concerted way.
And the watchdog
all
groups.
The watchdog groups, they all made the same point. The system is paralyzed, and something must be done. I think it will be.
Gil, thanks a lot for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Gil Chadwick covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke with me from Washington. We're looking tonight at allegations of an ethics black hole on Capitol Hill. Did you know that Republicans and Democrats in the House had cut a deal to not challenge each other's ethics? Which is worse, the partisan ethics witch hunts of the 90s or the non-aggression pact today? Do you expect a bar set higher than at flat-out criminality in the House of Representatives? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Shelley Pingree, President and CEO of Common Cause, the Citizens Lobby Group. She is the former State Senate Majority Leader in Maine. Good evening and welcome, Shelley Pingree.
Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. And with me from Dallas, Texas, is Russell Verney, Southwest Regional Director of Judicial Watch, a Washington-based legal and ethical watchdog group. Good evening and welcome, Russell Verney.
Good evening, Tom. It's a pleasure to be on with you and an honor to visit with your listeners.
Well, it's great to have you. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guests.
All right, Shelley and Russell, to you first. We've just heard from Gail Shattuck. This has been out there for 7 years. And she says, yes, it's a legitimate issue and a big issue, but the timing is all about the election this fall. Shelley Pingree, are you carrying water for the Democrats here?
Absolutely not. Common Cause is a nonpartisan organization. And, you know, from my experience as an elected official, I always felt that when there were ethics violations and no one dealt with them, it reflected on the entire institution.
Then why not last year? Why not the year before? Why in an election year, a presidential election year? It's been 7 years.
Well, I actually have to tell you, I've been at Common Cause for 1 year. So for as far as I can tell, this has been an issue every year. And now it's just gotten to the point where people are so frustrated that nothing is going on, that the truce has gotten sort of even more severe. And some of these violations are really serious, particularly the Nick Smith allegation. You know, that gets into criminal behavior. And at some point, I think if we don't all say it's got to stop, nobody calls enough attention to it. And this has come from both sides of the aisle. I think there are concerns on both sides about what's going on.
We're going to look down that laundry list, but Russell Verney, let me put it to you. Judicial Watch was very tough on Bill Clinton. You've got a kind of a conservative reputation. Have you been suckered into a Democratic campaign gambit here, or do we have a real problem with ethics on Capitol Hill?
Well, we're proudly conservative at Judicial Watch, but we believe that no one is above the law, including, as Will Rogers said, the only indigenous criminal class in America, which is Congress. They should not be above the law. We have been pushing this issue for years. We're glad to join with all these other groups and bring it out. I think, Tom, the difference is it's getting notice in the media because it's an election year, not among our groups and not speaking out from our groups because it's an election year.
But it is unusual to see all eight of these groups get together and make the big claim that we're in a kind of ethics free fall. Russell Verney, do you see a sort of critical mass of unaddressed ethics issues in the House of Representatives?
Without any question, there is. And I think you've got two very recent examples of them. Both the one Shelley just brought up about Congressman Smith believing or saying publicly that he had been offered a bribe for his vote. We also have the chairman of the committee that brought that huge Medicare bill, the first entitlement ever enacted under a Republican president, The very first one, a $540 billion bill goes through, and the chairman of the House committee resigns as chairman of the committee and considers an offer for multi-million dollars to go to work for the very beneficiaries of that bill.
We've got to name names here tonight. Can you put a name on that one, please?
Sure, Billy Tarzan.
Mm-hmm. Louisiana.
Congressman Billy Tarzan. Mm.
And he was considering a very, very fat paycheck from the very groups that his legislation was dealing with.
And I'm not sure that he isn't still considering it. He has resigned from the chairmanship. He's announced he's going to resign early from the House of Representatives, not going to seek reelection. And he probably won't consider the offer on the table till after he's resigned from the House. It's still an ethics violation, but they don't get it in Washington because Washington is an ethics-free zone and a shame-free zone.
And what's the salary that he's being or reportedly been offered for that job after his service in Congress?
It's been reported as multiple millions of dollars.
That's a pretty nice incentive on the other side of the rainbow. Shelley Pingree, take us into some of these others. First, you mentioned the Nick Smith case, the Michigan congressman. His son,
sure.
Brad, is looking to replace him. Give us the details of that story.
I'm sorry, say that again.
Well, I believe that Nick Smith's son, Brad, is planning to run for Nick Smith's seat when he retires. Is that right?
Absolutely. And one of the you know, things that was talked about on the floor was whether they would, not only pay off Nick Smith or interfere with the election of his son. As somebody said at the press conference the other day, that just wasn't ethics and politics. That was a crime. And sometimes the ethics committee waits until there are criminal violations before they speak up. We'd like to think that this elected body would look at itself when they were ethics violations. You know, the other one that's widely talked about is Representative Tom DeLay, who really controls the flow of everything going on in the House. Now, he recently announced a plan that he's establishing a children's charity with a 501c3 IRS tax deductible status,
right,
basically to subsidize donors at the Republican National Committee to go to high-end events. We look at this as a backdoor way around the new soft money ban that the Supreme Court upheld, kind of using the guise of children to do all the same things that you did, host all the big events and have access to elected officials.
Now, let's look at that, because that's not the way that Tom DeLay describes it. He says, look, I've got a children's charity here. People are going to contribute a lot of money, maybe $500,000 a pop. And if they do that, a little bit of this will go toward paying for some dinners at the Republican convention. This is good for kids. What's the problem?
Well, we're all in favor of making sure there are more charitable activities for kids, but have charitable activities for kids. The other side of this is the soft money ban said we need to break the ties between elected officials and big donors. And particularly when this is being done at the Republican convention, whether it was being done at the Republican or Democratic convention, it wouldn't matter. But this is a highly political event. Some of these tickets buy you into a box to buy the president's speech. These are expensive events, and we won't know till a year down the road, well after the elections, how much money was actually set aside for children. It's likely that much of it will be spent on these evenings where you're allowed access. You know, what we hear from a lot of people is that this is the hammer himself. Representative DeLay has a strong arm, and people don't want to challenge the way he's running things today, and that's part of why nothing is going on. I will tell you, we were attempting to have our members. We have over 200,000 members mm-hmm. around the country, and they often go to in-district meetings with their members of Congress. So we asked them to meet with the Health Ethics Committee Chairman Joel Heffley, Democratic Congressman Alan Mulholland, and
Joe
others.
Heffley, Republican from Colorado, Mulholland, Democrat, West Virginia, yeah.
Absolutely. And we were told no by their chiefs of staff, that they couldn't discuss ethics issues with their constituents. Well, it's kind of like, you people wouldn't understand this stuff. We have to talk about it just in private. And I think the public has a right to know. And again, these are the fundamentals of democracy. If we don't have faith in our elected officials, whichever party they're in, people just start saying, hey, they're all in the pockets of special interests and big business. Why bother? I don't even think I'll go to the polls.
Jack Beattie, things got pretty wild, maybe too wild in the 90s, but this kind of mutually agreed quiet is an odd and disturbing thing.
It is, and one of the constraints on this kind of behavior was fear of your constituents. But what we know, of course, in the modern age, and certainly since computer-generated gerrymandering, the politicians choose the voters. The voters don't choose the politicians. And they choose the voters on the basis either of ethnic or ideological compatibility. And in many cases, even if a person is found has severe ethical charges against him, people say he's an SOB, but he's our SOB. That is, he's compatible ethnically, an Adam Clayton Powell, or ideologically, you know, one of these Mr. DeLay.
And off we go. But there's got to be a check somewhere. We've got to take a short break. Jack, Shelley, Russell, we'll be right back. We're talking tonight about the disappearance of ethics oversight on Capitol Hill. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about allegations of an ethics black hole on Capitol Hill in the U.S. House of Representatives. In particular, we're joined tonight by Shelley Pingree. She's president and CEO of Common Cause. From Dallas, Texas, by Russell Verney, director of the Southwest Region of Judicial Watch. Our own Jack Beatty is with us. You can join us as well. Who do you think is minding the ethics store in Congress? Did you know that Republicans and Democrats in the House have cut a deal not to challenge each other's ethics? And do you expect an ethical bar set higher than flat-out criminality? Have your standards fallen as low as the Congress's standards? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Shelley Pingree, how do you draw the line? Of course, there are many facets to what makes an ethical behavior in Congress. But where do you draw the line? What's okay and what's not? We saw that the rules have been changed recently so that congressmen can accept trips and go out to visit lobbying groups and so on and have their travel and their stay paid at fancy resorts. Where's the line? Where should it be?
Well, you know, I mean, most people have a sort of gut sense about the difference between right and wrong and when something is exerting undue influence. And one of the interesting things is that while there were, you know, under the original days of Newt Gingrich, there were an increase in the ethics rules, most of them have been rolled back, just such as things that you said, the gift ban, which we opposed the rollback of that, and other kinds of conflicts of interest statutes, misuse of campaign finance contributions, and certainly this kind of coercion on the floor where people are, you know, in the final hour, where they're keeping the vote open 2 or 3 hours longer than normal, trying to twist arms, use money, and used all kinds of pressuring tactics to get a vote. As somebody said, you know, it's not any fun if you win by cheating, and it's not the right thing in the long run if that's how you go about doing it. The truth is, you know, most Americans make ethical decisions every day, and you know in your gut when you're doing the right thing, and frankly, there are strict rules in Congress about what you should and shouldn't do. The problem is, you know, we all speed once in a while in our cars, and if there's not a policeman sitting by the side of the road, sometimes you're not reminded that there will be a consequence if you get caught, and that's what we're concerned about here, is if you got rules, people have to feel like they're being enforced.
Russell Verney, help us look at a few more of the cases that have gotten everyone's attention. James Moran, Democrat, Virginia, he supported the bankruptcy bill, but before he did, there was a loan from a company, a bank, that would be a big beneficiary of that bill.
One of the largest companies in the United States that handles credit cards, MBNA, made a personal loan to Jim Moran, and then shortly after that, he came out in support of the bankruptcy bill. You know, we shouldn't get off into fantasy land, though, Tom. Washington has never had a lot of ethics. What we do need, though, as Shelley pointed out, is a place to hold somebody accountable for not even looking into these, whether it's the members of the Ethics Committee if they refuse to take them up, but just to have no opportunity to raise these issues of Jim Moran or think about Gary Condit, a man who impeded a criminal investigation or a missing persons investigation. There's lots of them that should have been brought up and somebody held accountable for not doing anything about those investigations.
You're saying even Gary Condit was a beneficiary of this non-aggression pact?
Yeah, there were never any ethics charges brought up against Gary Condit for his impeding of the investigation into the missing intern that he was having an affair with.
And you don't get much more high profile than that. Shelley Pingree, how about the case of Paul Kanjorski, Democrat, Pennsylvania? The shorthand here is he steered $9 million in contracts to family businesses. An ethical issue?
Well, absolutely. And unfortunately, there's a tremendous amount of money spent on contracts today. You know, we're watching them, whether it's Iraq, whether it's local. And one of the big concerns is about influence of those contracts. I think something like $2.3 trillion is the current size of the federal budget, and government contracts have ballooned over 43% during the last time period as that budget has grown. So, you know, you have to say how do you make sure that people don't do this? You have to have a policing organization so people know there's somebody looking over your shoulder. It is all too tempting, unfortunately, to, you know, have a conversation, move into territory you shouldn't be in, and find yourself doing something you shouldn't be doing.
Too tempting, too easy, and all kinds of lobbying money flying around. We'll look at that as well. Listeners, what do you think? Has the country given up on ethics in office? Can we afford to do that? We're at 1-800-423-8255. David's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening.
The answer to your opening question is have I sunk that low? No, unfortunately. I have to stand up.
Good.
Upright to do my job. Maybe Ralph Nader's right. Maybe there isn't a difference between the two parties. But the question that I have is, isn't there some system within the Constitution, checks and balances, when you have a complete and utter breakdown of one of the three branches, where another branch simply has to step in and police that branch? I mean, does the Supreme Court have any sort of authority over the legislative body when it is incapable of doing its job?
David, that is a great question, and I thank you for raising it. Jack Beatty, let me turn to you on that. We've got separation of powers. Now we've got what seems to be a kind of paralysis around ethics in the House in particular. What do you do?
I don't know what you do. One thing, of course, I mean, Justice Brandeis said that publicity is the great disinfectant. So you have programs like this. You talk about these people. But there are these structural problems. I mentioned one of them, the incumbent proof. Essentially, the incumbents are proof against any challenge at the polls. In the last election, I think we did an analysis of this. There were only 20 races of the 435 that were decided by 10 points or more. In other words, there were very few races that were decided that weren't overwhelming. So these incumbents are so entrenched. And really, you have the Edwin Edwards standard. You know, when he was governor of Louisiana, he said, I'm going to be governor here unless I'm found in bed either with a live boy or a dead woman. And that's almost the standard now. Look at the people who lost her in the last election. Cynthia McKinney, Gary Condit, Traficant. There was another flagrant character. We're right about there. And the only sanction can come from the voters if the houses won't do it themselves. But as I suggest, the voters are wired in.
The gerrymandering is so specific that the outrage doesn't tip them out easily.
It doesn't tip them out. And look at how long Traficant went on out there. It's just harder and harder to do. Effectively, we have eliminated one of the systemic checks, which are, you know, my gosh, I'll get voted out of office if I'm cut. No, you won't.
Tom,
Russell Fernie, please.
Tom, back in the early 90s, yep. There was a big move around the country for term limits, and it's a bad idea, but its time has come. As was just explained, There are no competitive seats in the House of Representatives unless somebody chooses not to run for re-election for one reason or another. The revolution of the Republicans in 1994, 91% of all incumbents won re-election. When more than 9 out of 10 win re-election, that's not much of a revolution. So we don't have the opportunity to hold them accountable at the ballot box because of the system of gerrymandering that's done under redistricting. The only time the courts can be called into play in something like this is when a criminal event occurs, as in the case of the lawmaker from Ohio.
Traficant, yep.
Traficant. And the executive branch has no authority whatsoever, except perhaps through the U.S. Attorney's Office, Attorney General, to bring a charge to the courts. But the ballot box is our only choice. If there's no ability there to have a competitive race, then it's term limits. It's a bad idea, but their time has come.
So voters really have to make ethics a high priority. Shelley Pinger, you point at the scale of money floating around as one of the problems here. A story in the Washington Post just today, a very striking story about the Washington lobbyist Jack Abramoff and Michael Scanlon, former spokesman for the House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, Republican, Texas. They received, the Washington Post reports today, more than $45 million in lobbying and public affairs work from newly wealthy Native American tribes in the past 3 years doing lobbying around casino work. $45 million for a former Tom DeLay spokesman and his partner. That is an enormous pile of dough.
Well, it was a shocking and very discouraging story, and I think one of the chiefs said there was some turmoil in the tribes, and one of the newly elected chiefs said, you know, we basically spent $14 million of our money and got nothing in return. What was really discouraging about this story is that, you know, this is what General Electric or a major corporation spends when they have a bill on the floor that they're lobbying through, the pharmaceutical manufacturers on Medicare. But you know what? There was nothing going on. There were no major issues. There was no bill they were lobbying. It was just general, you know, slush money to increase the visibility of the tribes or whatever, really just to enhance the salaries of these particular lobbyists who were let go for their law from their law firm. We don't know what all the backdoor conversations were, but clearly there were some serious considerations going on there. And that is typical of the kind of money that is out there today, which again speaks to some of the problems in the system. I mean, when we talk about our concerns about government today, we look at all kinds of systemic problems, which I do think have reached sort of a boiling point, whether it's campaign finance reform, the amount of money that's going to be raised in this presidential election on both sides, the redistricting issue that people have been mentioning, and the lack of competitive elections anymore, ethics and accountability. It's in state houses. It's in at the national level, the process in general. And you generally don't think about, you know, who wants to talk about process issues? We've got to talk about, you know, environmental problems and medical problems. Well, the fact is, this is at the root of why things aren't working very well today.
Bill is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi. I guess I just want to make a comment. The sad fact that I don't vote and haven't voted in a long time, because I just feel like all the politicians are crooks and criminals. I feel pretty disgusted with my fellow Americans for being so stupid, if I can be harsh, to get excited about this person running or that one.
But Bill, if you don't vote, you don't have any leverage whatsoever, do you?
I don't really feel like I have any leverage either, and I hope everyone doesn't do what I do, but it's just the way I feel. And as you know, Jack said, the voters are wired in. They're like they're right in there. They're excited about this candidate or that, and they're all a bunch of crooks. So I mean, you know, what difference does it make? They're all just getting very rich.
But Bill, ultimately, doesn't it count on voters to get more involved, not less, if it's going to get fixed? Isn't that what we're hearing?
I don't know. I don't know if that will fix it or not. I'll tell you, if a candidate running for president ever stands up and says, I did inhale and have been inhaling ever since, I might vote for him just because I'm on it.
Honesty, wherever it may fall. Bill, thanks very much for your call. Let's get another call in here. We've got another Bill calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hello.
Evening.
I had like the other fellow, I had a comment. I'm of two minds on this issue. It's great to hear you talking about it all of a sudden, but the second part is, why now? And I wonder whether, you know, your previous comment talked about how everybody's in it together. Well, that sort of would seem to create a sideshow while Mr. Cheney is rope-a-doping on one side of the ring. It sort of takes the pressure off him, I would think.
What, are you saying don't paint everybody, both parties, with the same brush?
Well, I guess I would like to do that. We all watched while they raid Clinton over the coals on Whitewater and stuff, and I'd sort of like to see the same thing, same standard be applied to the current guys in office.
So why do they get a pass? Russell Verney, it is tempting, and Bill, thanks for your call. It is tempting to look at this, Russell, and say, wait a minute. We had, a free fire zone, sort of the Wild West on this front during what were, in effect, the Clinton years. Why should it be tamped down during a GOP administration?
Well, I don't believe that it should be tamped down during any administration, GOP or Democrat. And in fact, you know, this whole issue was out there during the Democratic administration of Clinton when he did all those coffees and when we even had testimony from the guy that wanted to build that pipeline across the Middle East there, that he gave $700,000, and if he had it to do again, he'd give twice as much and get more for his money. We're raising the same issues now as we raised during the Clinton administration. We don't believe that one side gets a pass on anything.
Let's get another call. Jim is calling from Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening.
I'd like to suggest that one way to straighten out Washington, D.C., and also an effective means of term limits is to no longer allow any of these elected officials to get a retirement when they leave.
If they were ever under the same health care benefits you were under, if they were under Social Security, you think we'd have problems with that system now? No, they give themselves pay raises, $4,000 a year pay raises out of your pocket without you getting a vote on it. They give themselves a wonderful retirement program and a tremendous health care program. They don't care what goes on with Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security.
Russell Verney, we hear that, but Jim, I want to ask you exactly what you mean. I mean, why cut them off from retirement, A, and B, how would you accomplish that? They've got to vote on that.
Well, they are supposed to be citizen legislators, by the way we were founded.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not supposed to be lifelong professional politicians. I have a real problem with being represented by somebody who at one point in time was a school teacher, then ran for office, went to Washington, D.C., and became a millionaire.
Are you talking about Gingrich?
Well, I'm talking about Oberstar from Minnesota.
Oh, Oberstar, all right. I mean, Newt Gingrich was doing some teaching there, as I recall, as well. Well, there you go. So you'd cut off the benefits so it's not such an attractive long-term career.
That is exactly right.
Jim, we've got it. Shelley, you know, there's citizen outrage, call for dramatic action, but how's that ever going to happen? These are the guys who have the votes.
Well, you've got to find a middle ground here. I mean, we've done some ethics complaints in looking at, say, Senator Stevens from Alaska, who seems to have made a tremendous amount of money since he's been in office chairing the Appropriations Committee. I do think you have to ask questions about the amount of money people make when they're in positions of tremendous influence. The other side of it is if you really want to have a citizen-like legislature, if you really want the average person to have the opportunity to run, one, you got to change the campaign finance laws so that you either have public financing or some way that everybody has a level playing field, and it's not just for millionaires or people who know millionaires. And then you've got to have a reasonable salary to run on. Maybe you don't have to stay there your whole life, but the fact is when you're an elected official, you don't pay into Social Security, so you have to have some sort of retirement system to make this reasonable. Frankly, what happens is, like I said, a lot of people with a lot of money are able to do this. There's a tremendous number of millionaires in the United States Senate, but what we really want is the average working person to say, you know what, I want to stand up and represent the people of my community, the people who look like me. I want to go to Washington and serve, and I think there's a lot in the system, whether it's redistricting, campaign finance reform, or just the ability for millionaires to know other millionaires and do more of this that keeps the average person from doing it. And frankly, I would love to see greater diversity of the people who serve us in Congress, and I think it would serve us very well.
Jack Beatty, in the meantime, if you care to donate $500,000 to Celebrations for Children, Inc., this is Tom DeLay's Children's Fund, mm-hmm. you will have private dinners before and after the convention with
hey,
Tom DeLay and his colleagues and high staffers. You will have a yacht cruise. You will have a luxury hospitality suite for big donors, VIP tickets to Broadway shows, a private golf tournament, late night parties, and a box to observe President Bush. It's for the kids, Jack. Come on.
It's all for the kids. You know, Bill from Cambridge said had a cynical take on this, but a quick, inspiring last story. Sam Rayburn, one of 10 kids, when he went to college, his father was a dirt farmer. His father put $25 in his hand, shook his hand, and said, Sam, be a man. And Sam Rayburn, when he was elected to the Senate, to the State House in Texas, would not ride the railroad home because they lobbied. He would not ride the railroad home from Washington because they had interest before the Congress.
Right.
And when Sam Rayburn died, he was Speaker of the House for 10 years. He left an estate of $15,000.
There you go, folks. That's no millionaire. We're talking about the black hole of ethics on Capitol Hill. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the disappearance of ethics oversight on Capitol Hill. We're joined by Shelley Pingree of Common Cause, Russell Verney of Judicial Watch. You can join the conversation as well. How do we get this mess cleaned up? 1-800-423-8255. Milton is calling from Marshfield, Massachusetts. Hi, Milt. You're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom. I appreciate the show. I have 2 points, and the second one comes out of the first.
Okay.
It seems like to me that part of the issue here is that the inmates are allowed to run the asylum, as some of your callers have pointed out, as far as the Congress people get to decide for themselves what the rules are. And at that point, my second point being, I wish the media would play a more critical role in this. I appreciate your show tonight, but I'm afraid groups like NPR are few and far between, and the Washington Post may run an occasional story, but there's no tenacious watchdog media going after, because the media is owned by the same company that are lobbying all the Congress people.
Well, let us pick that up, Milton, and thank you very much for your call. Russell Verney, how about it? We heard earlier Gail Shattuck with the Christian Science Monitor quoting Nancy Pelosi saying, yes, we'll get on these things if they're very serious, but saying, you guys, the media that is, have to bring it up. Is the media doing its job? Has everybody come to accept too much as just standard here? Do we need a higher outrage level?
Well, everything we know about these transgressions of members of Congress, we've gotten through the media. So it isn't that the media is not doing the job. Nancy Pelosi is saying, do my job for me. If you see a transgression, don't just report it. Editorialize about it, campaign on it until you force me to do something about the transgression of one of the members of this body.
Well, what's so wrong with that? Isn't that one of the roles of a free press in a democracy, to beat the drum when things aren't right?
Well, it's our right to beat the drum. I don't know that it's their obligation to go out and do Nancy Pelosi or Dennis Hastert's job for them. When a transgression occurs or is alleged to have occurred and somebody brings it to the attention of the Ethics Committee, they should investigate it, not say, we're not going to take any report on that because it didn't come from a member of the House of Representatives. Mm. We're not going to take a report on that because it was in the newspaper, not brought to us by one of the members of the House of Representatives. They should be jumping on this and policing themselves to ensure to the American public that there's the highest standard of representation there, not the lowest common denominator.
And not just be shutting it down. Let's get one more call. Tom is calling from Cranston, Rhode Island. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The information you're sharing is so discouraging, but on the same hand, it's creating this slow burning and anger.
A slow burn, I hope, and maybe a high burn.
Yeah, and I guess that's what I'm looking for. You know, recently even the information about Justice Scalia, who won't recluse himself from a thing that seems very obvious to anyone.
Out duck hunting with Vice President
exactly.
Cheney when they've got a case of his coming before the Supreme Court.
Exactly. And so, it goes all the way up to the highest court in the land where you can't seem as a citizen to get even a break. And almost, I wish that if there were some organization, groups that organize these protests and marches, like against the World Bank and the World Trade Organization. But I think I find myself that I'd go to New York and I'd go to Boston and I would stand with a sign protesting the people who are getting on the boats and the dinners and giving the money and asking and where it's going, because I just feel like it's not a democracy anymore.
Well, it can get close to that point, and that's what we're hearing from these groups tonight, that there comes a point you really do have to stand up somehow. Tom, thanks very much for your call. Shelley Pingree, quick last question here. The issue was raised by Gail, whether or not this was partisan. And nevertheless, it has been a Republican administration these last years. Compare the 90s and now. Are we in worse circumstances now, and is it somehow related to having Republicans in the White House or not?
Well, I think you can have one party control anywhere. You see a lot of state legislatures where there's one party control and there's all kinds of corruption that goes on. And often that's just what happens when you get a little bit too full of yourself and you control everything. And, we complained at Common Cause about the Lincoln bedroom, about Speaker Wright. I mean, we're happy to take on whoever it is.
The Democrats
that's violating ethics.
Yep.
Because I believe, in the long run, like you hear from these callers, they all say, well, I think they're all crooks. Nobody gets an advantage in this one. And even though, there were suggestions earlier that this was partisan, I can tell you the Democrats don't like us saying that we think that they ought to be calling for these ethics of investigations.
You're
because a lot of people would
too.
Rather sit on the sidelines.
Yep.
I do want to just say to your last caller, there are a lot of groups who work on this issue. There are a lot of people who are going to be protesting conventions and other things. Certainly suggest you go to our website, commoncause.org, where we look at issues like the media, like steps you can take to talk to your own member of Congress about what you want them to do on this. I mean, it is important people speak up.
Well, absolutely. Listeners, buck up, don't give up, and let's do it. Shelley Pingree, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Shelley Pingree, President and CEO of Common Cause, and Russell Verney in Dallas. Terrific having you with us. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you, Tom. It's been an honor.
Russell Verney, Director of the Southwest Region of Judicial Watch. Jack Beatty, it's good to hear the response out there. Let's hope it can turn into something.
Yeah, we're going to have more of these indignation meetings. Throw the bums out.
Every once in a while, you've got to have it. Jack, thanks
yes.
for being with us.
Thank you.
Stay with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. President Bush today launched what is expected by November to be the most expensive political advertising campaign ever, with four television commercials that will air across the country. Rather than focusing on specific accomplishments, the ads seek to portray the president as a steady leader in a world of uncertainty.
The last few years have tested America in many ways. Some challenges we've seen before, and some were like no others. But America rose to the challenge. What sees us through tough times? Freedom, faith, families, and sacrifice. President Bush, steady leadership in times of change.
Three of the ads include images from the September 11th terrorist attacks, which has angered some family members of 9/11 victims who are accusing the president of exploiting their suffering for political gain. It's a slap in the face of the murders of 3,000 people, said Monica Gabriel, whose husband died at the World Trade Center. But Bush's campaign manager, Ken Millman, defended the ads, saying the 9/11 attacks are, quote, critical to who this president is. Joining me to dissect President Bush's new campaign ads are Todd Domke, Republican media consultant. Welcome, Todd.
Good to be with you.
And Dan Payne, a media consultant for Democrats. Welcome, Dan.
Thank you.
So here we are. We just heard one 30-second ad. We've basically have three ads here, one of them which is also run in Spanish to make the fourth. They're going to run in 60 local markets in 17 states, plus a lot of cable, CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, Fox Sports, ESPN. Todd, to you first. What do you make of the ads? What is the president attempting to do here?
Well, the basic message is that President Bush has taken us through tough times, but things are getting better. And implicit is the message that this is no time to change horses in midstream, especially an unsteady liberal horse from Massachusetts. But what's most interesting is in terms of strategy that's revealed by this and tactics. It's obviously the beginning of framing what the choice is all about. The contrast is steady leadership, implying that Kerry is not steady, in this case reinforced by Bush in public speaking recently, making the case that Kerry is a flip-flopper, which others have also explained and documented. And that also implicit is that he's not a real leader. You know, it's one thing to be a talker in the Senate. It's another thing to actually take
action. George Bush has walked through the fire.
And he's proven himself. That's right. So much of this is kind of a reminder, sort of beginning this. I mean, it's sort of framing a picture. This is the frame. Now, after this commercial, he'll start to paint the picture.
Dan Payne, an effective start for the president's big money campaign against John Kerry?
Well, it was a necessary beginning. Bush has had a terrible couple of months. The war is going badly. The economy is going badly. He's had problems within his administration. He's got Republicans worried about the deficit, complaining publicly about how the spending is out of control. He's really got to pull things together, and he needed to start positively. He had to explain himself that as he says in one of the commercials, I know exactly what I want to do. He has to prove that he has some control over this government. I was also struck by the eagerness with which the Bush campaign began. I mean, they could hardly wait for John Edwards to concede.
Get out of there so we can launch.
So now we can go after Kerry. And Bush went after him, out on the stump yesterday. So they're very eager to get their licks in on John Kerry.
Well, the fact is, as you've said, Ton, he's got something like $100 million he has to spend before the Republican convention, because after that it goes to publicly funded campaigning, and so he's got to spend on these ads. And, well, this is the first phase, the positive phase, laying down the base of here's what the president has been through with you, here's what he's done. Attack ads will come.
That's right. But what scares Kerry and his supporters is what, like I said, this implies. I mean, for example, when he characterizes himself as an optimist, he's also implying that Kerry, just like Dan's analysis, has been relentlessly negative. That's everything.
Did I say that?
That basically, yeah.
Trying to raise that contrast.
I said bad things happen to Bush. I didn't say Kerry
made
them happen.
Basically, it's
but implicitly, that's what's going on.
That's right. And also, it's that he's really trying to take the high ground on some of these issues. But what's most important, I think, is by emphasizing the idea of steady leadership, implying that Kerry is, and saying that Kerry is, a flip-flopper, he's trying to force Kerry to stay with the liberal, very liberal positions he's taken during the Democratic primary.
And not let him move back to the middle. Very interesting. Let's listen to the soundtrack of the full 60-second ad. To picture this, this is a series, a montage of some still images and video, the president at some point sitting next to the first lady, images of firefighters, construction workers, children, the elderly. It starts with George Bush walking past a column that we've all seen him walking along at the White House. Let's listen to the full 60-second soundtrack here.
One of the things that must never change is the entrepreneurial spirit of America. This country needs a president who clearly sees that.
The strength, the focus, the characteristics that these times demand.
And as the economy grows, the job base grows, and somebody who's looking for work will be more likely to find a job. I know exactly where I want to lead this country. I know what we need to do to make the world more free and more peaceful. I know what we need to do to make sure every person has a chance at realizing the American dream. I know what we need to do to continue economic growth so people can find work, to raise the standards in schools so children can learn, to fulfill the promise to America's seniors. Americans are hardworking, decent, generous people. I'm optimistic about America because I believe in the people of America. I'm President Bush, and I approve of this message.
The woman's voice early in that ad that you hear saying the strength, the focus, the character that these times demand, that is Laura Bush sitting at the president's side. And, of course, as you said, Dan, President Bush saying, I know exactly what this country needs. I want to ask each of you about the 9/11 image issue. When you see these ads, these are quick images from Ground Zero, just a little bit of skeletal structure there and rubble and a flag superimposed. Todd, offensive? Some survivors' families have said so.
No, I don't think so. I think, again, those who support Kerry will find anything about Bush offensive.
All survivors? Families are Kerry supporters?
No, I don't know if those particular ones are Democrats. I mean, but it's a national tragedy. It's not just a tragedy for those who lost lives directly, but also it has to be addressed by Bush. It changed his whole presidency. Mm. It defined his presidency. It changed the economy. It changed the military. It changed law enforcement. It changed all of us.
Fair game, 9/11 images for this president?
Well, I leave that up to the people who are most intimately affected. I'm not sure you can quickly dismiss them as Democrats. And, you know, it seems to me that the Bush campaign is doing consciously in this commercial what Democrats expect is going to happen the entire campaign, and that is campaign on 9/11. He's going to be in New York at his convention. I was struck by a couple of other things. Listening to it on the, you know, just the audio track mm-hmm. only, the melancholy music was surprising to me. It doesn't feel as melancholy when you see it on TV. Also, you have Bush looking and hard working. He's dropping those G's again, trying to seem like a much more ordinary man.
He's with the people, and many images of ordinary people trying to shed that friend of the fat cat's idea. There is a third ad which has no words voiced. It's just words on the screen. An economy in recession, it says, a stock market in decline, a dot-com boom gone bust, then a day of tragedy. Todd, this to say the president was dealt a tough hand.
Which is true. I mean, it's to remind people that, you know, the economy was ready to go into recession as soon as he took office. 9/11 happened, which was an economic shock. The dot-com bust, obviously not his fault.
But it's remarkably downbeat. Is this just the opening phase, and then we're going to get the Morning in America stuff later?
It is, but it also will set up the contrast to John Kerry, again, who hasn't really shown results as a leader, has been ineffectual in the Senate, and who doesn't want to be judged even by his voting record, how he voted against intelligence spending, how he voted against the military.
And that's going to come up. Dan, last thought. President Bush has a huge campaign chest. John Kerry has a very small one at this point. Is there any way John Kerry can compete on television ads?
Well, no, he can't. He's going to have to make the argument through the free media. He's going to have to try to raise money if he can. He's going to get a little help from Move On, the Bush critics, who are going to put a couple $1 million into this into the campaign, at least to start from. I think it's interesting, too. The one thing that is not in any of the Bush commercials is Iraq.
Not a glimpse, not a soldier that I've seen.
There's one woman in a camouflage outfit. She's the only appearance that the war makes in this commercial. I think it's very telling.
Well, much more to come. A great big bulldozer of money that's going to be pushing behind these ads. Todd Domke, Republican media consultant, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you.
Daniel Payne, Democratic media consultant, thanks to you.
You're welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.